gentlemen, I'm Doug Gottlieb, and you are listening to All Ball, All Basketball, All the Time. Although we have a special guest today, doesn't totally fit with that, but still it's a fascinating story you're going to like and bless. Let me just kind of give you some quick thoughts on what we've seen so far in the Elite Eight, now leading to the Final Four. And the first thing is, you know, like, I don't hate saying I told you so, but I told you so. Gonzaga's that good. They just are. And what's impressive is, you know, you take what Drew Timmy did, and we're recording this on a Wednesday after the Elite Eight, which is on a Tuesday. I mean, that he's the kind of kid, like, let's not get it twisted. Yes, because they can shoot, because they have so many implied threats, if you will, it's really hard to zone them because you get spaced out. But that's really the way that USC had played that zone since they put it in. The difference is that Drew Timmy dominated Evan Mobley. And he's the kind of kid who's like, oh, really? He's a top three pick? I'm going to kick his ass. And that's exactly what happened. So you have a mix of age, experience, two-point guards, quality coaching, just enough depth, give guys breaks. But I actually like teams that have that kind of perfect depth, right, where you know, you just get in a better rhythm when you're only playing seven or eight. You play 10, like, sometimes it can be hard to establish a rhythm and fail early in the game. Obviously, they didn't fail early yesterday. But, you know, Kispert didn't even make shots. And they missed, I think, 13 or 14 layups. And they still mollywopped USC. Like, that's how good they are. And they're the perfect mix of age, experience, you know, youthful vigor with Jalen Suggs and quality coaching. You know, Big 12 people tell me, hey, Baylor is just as good. They're better defensively. And I think it's going to be Baylor and Gonzaga. But I think, you know, when I said Gonzaga or the field going back to November 26th, I've been doing it periodically throughout the year. There's a reason. Like, they're better than everybody else. I don't know how UCLA won that game. I really don't. And I guess the easy way to say is like, hey, Mick Cronin is a tough-ass dude. And he got all those kids to become tough. Like, those are mostly Southern California kids too. You know, Tiger's not, but the rest of them are. And I think it's fascinating to go, you know, the narrative has always been, you know, SoCal kids are soft or whatever. Did they look soft last night? Like, that was a Pier 6 brawl. For Michigan, you know, they never really had the type of, obviously not having Livers hurts them offensively, but I would say that they managed it pretty well. I mean, Johns was outstanding in the tournament ever since Livers went down. But they did it without the type of wings that they've had, where you can Caris LeVert, a Tim Hardaway, you know, a guy who can go get you a bucket. I actually think that we'll look back and go, you know, with two grad transfers. I mean, Chudney Brown was a kind of godsend there when Livers went out, gives them points off the bench. And Mike Smith was just solid all year long, right? But with two grad transfers to make it work, I think that's really outstanding stuff. And, you know, it's the type of thing that they can build upon. And I just think for Michigan, they're just going to have to be careful. Now they're recruiting at a much higher level than they did with John Beilein, but will they still have the same type of character that they've had throughout this entire time? I think the answer is yes, because Juwan Howard strikes me as a no-nonsense guy. Seems to totally get it, right? And, I mean, you look at how limited the minutes were for his own son. I mean, there's a guy who, he understands how this thing all works. I think Michigan's going to be a problem in that league for a long time. You know, that the staff is really good, the coaching's really good, and Juwan gives them just enough pop in terms of kind of cool cred and NBA cred that it's definitely going to work. Yeah, could you nitpick about a couple of things last night? Like, sure, of course you can. And they got beat by a team that I would say they have a little bit more talent than, and the matchup should have favored them a little bit more in terms of scoring inside. But like, if the game's going to be officiated that way and UCLA is going to meet the challenge, which they did, it's pretty fantastic. And look, Michigan missed layups down the stretch. I would have to think fatigue played a factor. They've been in Indy since like the end of the first week in March, right? You lose lose to Michigan State, and then they pack their bags and head to Indy. They've been there ever since. That mentally and physically wears you down. No question about it. And then, you know, as far as Houston's concerned, we've had Kelvin on the pod. You should download it. Go check it out. Kelvin Sampson, the All Ball Pod, told his story. But those of us who, you know, we're all going to talk about Baylor and that rebuild job, which has been remarkable, but also been chronicled. And they've been good now for most of the past 15 years or 10 years, whatever. Houston just was apathetic. They didn't care. You know, they couldn't get anybody to go to Hoff Hines. Hoff Hines is a dump. And, you know, now they got it. Now they got it going. They truly got it going on. I just don't think they can score with Baylor. And Baylor is an impressive, impressive squad in terms of their ability to score the basketball. And then, you know, like, look, what we missed on, I think, with the Pac-12 is how decimated those programs have been by the NBA draft consistently. And, you know, the reason that league hasn't gotten the best seeds, but look, Arizona was a one seed a couple years ago. They just completely pooped the bed, or two seeds, excuse me, pooped the bed against the Buffalo team that was probably underseeded. But still, you should beat Buffalo. Some has been poor performance in the NCAA tournament, which they have no one to blame. But and some, quite frankly, has been the fact that because they're constantly having to put together their teams on the fly, right, you keep having to build new teams and new teams and more new teams. Like, that's not going to work long term. And it hasn't worked long term for them. So I think there's a reason just behind the Pac-12 struggles more so than their TV deals weren't any good. The TV deals were actually really, really good considering how few people wanted to watch.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
We've done a ton of really, really interesting interviews. I wanted to take this one kind of sidestep for a reason, because I'm fascinated by Alex Honnold, who's a rock climber, like go climb a rock, right? You keep your mom always, go play in the freeway, go climb a rock. Well, he is probably the best known climber in the country. He, when he was climbing El Capitan, right, which is in Yosemite, El Cap, or whatever is what the kids call it. They filmed a movie called Free Solo. If you haven't seen it, it's amazing. I mean, truly amazing. A free solo climb of fame, El Capitan, which is a 900 meter vertical face rock in Yosemite National Forest. It's, I mean, pretty intense to just look at. I mean, all these, you just even look at the photos of it, and he's climbing up, and I mean, how they filmed it is fascinating. So I thought you'd be interested in it. He's got a new podcast out. Plus, not sure if you're aware of this, but climbing is an Olympic sport now. Olympic sport. So without further ado, let's catch up with the foremost free climber in the country, Alex Honnold.
Okay, so first time you ever climbed something, like not just like climb the tree, like my son's just turned 12. He likes to climb tree. First time you ever like actually put the harnesses on or free and or just climb without anything, like without a harness.
The first time ever?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so I actually started climbing like your son, climbing trees, climbing structures, climbing buildings, having a good time. And then when I was 10, maybe, or maybe 11, I went to a climbing gym for the first time. So going indoors, using harnesses and climbing in a more structured rock climbing way. And then the first time climbing by myself without a rope was probably when I was 19 or 20, just at some of the cliffs near where I grew up in Sacramento.
Did like you start climbing things without ropes, without protection? Do you naturally, innately not have like the normal fear that normal human being, right? There's a lot to the sport, which amazes me, right? The dexterity of being able to contort your body and how you train for that is amazing. The strength in your wrists as well. And I'm sure your weight is really important, right? Like there's no chance that you're disproportionate anyway. And you know, the less you weigh, obviously the easier it is, but you have to maintain your strength. But just the lack of fear, that's where I have three children, and I didn't actually know it until I became a parent, which is all sports are kind of the same. you have to get over this level of fear. And if you can't, it's okay. That's not your lane. So is this just something with climbing that you don't have, like a fear of falling or heights, or is that your personality?
Well, I mean, I think, I don't know. I mean, it's a tough question in a way, because, you know, it's been my entire life. So it's hard to parse out how much is just practice. I mean, basically I've been climbing full time for 25 years. So obviously it's not scary for me anymore, because it's all I've done for my entire life, basically. But I think that mostly the overcoming fear has been a product of practice, you know, preparation, like just exposure, basically exposure therapy. But I think that I was sort of innately more drawn to the positions. Like, I like the exposure. I like being up high. Like, I really like getting on top of things, you know, like even as a kid, I like standing on top of play structures and things, standing on top of the swing set. So, you know, I think there's that innate draw, but when I was young, I mean, it was scary. You know, the idea of falling off a cliff is still scary. It's just that now I feel very comfortable that I'm not going to fall off the cliff, you know, basically through practice. You just realize what you can and can't do.
When people hear that it's going to be in the Olympics, I think the first question is, well, how do you judge it? Like, where is the judging in the gold medalist to never hurt you guy?
So, there's already a really robust World Cup circuit for climbing. So there's already a whole competition framework for rock climbing. And right now there are three different disciplines, and the Olympic format combines all three of those disciplines into one medal. But so the three disciplines, the three sort of subsets are judged in different ways. One is speed, just the fastest person up the wall. One is difficulty, where whoever climbs the highest up the route wins. And then one is bouldering, which is basically the same, whoever climbs the highest wins, but it's on boulders, which means it's smaller height. So there's no rope involved. You know, you just climb very, very physically hard problems that are, you know, say under 15 feet high. And when you fall, you land on a gymnastic pad. But so basically they take the top scores of those three formats and combine them into an overall climbing champion.
Who's the Jordan? And by Jordan, I mean, not currently the best, but the one who kind of laid the framework for all this stuff to happen.
Oh, that's hard to say, actually. I don't know. I don't know if I know my basketball well enough to fit all the key climbing.
Well, like the person, guys, this is the guy, like Tiger Woods. Like Tiger Woods is most of the golfers that play the younger guys now, they're like, man, I got into golf because Tiger Woods made it kind of cool to play golf.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, you know, to be honest, like to some extent, I'm filling that role partially just because the film Free Solo has been such a popular vehicle for people to get into climbing. You know, people see the movie in theaters, they're like, that's crazy. And then they go to the climbing gym, they check it out, they enjoy it, and they get into the sport. But I think in terms of, you know, dominating the sport of climbing, I mean, currently it might be a climber named Adam Ondra, who's from the Czech Republic. He's European. He'll be going to the Olympics and has a decent shot at winning. Though the format is a little bit weird, so it's like really anybody's game at the Olympics. But
which of the three disciplines is he the best in?
He's the best at lead climbing and bouldering, so basically the two forms of difficulty. But he's a pretty bad speed climber, so that's why it's a bit of a shot. You know, everyone has a good shot at it, basically.
What's your strength?
Well, my strength is sort of totally outside of what they're doing in the Olympics, sort of like ultra distance.
Right.
Because if you think of something like El Cap, it's it's literally hundreds of times taller than the walls in the Olympics. And so, you know, if competitive climbing is sort of like running sprints, I'm out doing like ultra marathons through the mountains, basically. It's like a whole different sport.
Okay, so let's get in the movie. Okay, when the first idea of it should be a movie came from you? Came from who?
No, it came from the filmmakers, Jimmy Chin and Chai Vassarelli, the co-directors. They approached me about doing a feature film, and it just so happened.
What year is this? What year is this?
This is 2015, maybe, like basically a couple years before the film.
Okay, so you're how old at the time?
I guess I was 30.
So how'd they decide you're the guy?
Well, I'd already done tons of cutting edge free solos within the climbing community. So, and Jimmy and I had traveled on many climbing expeditions together. So we'd worked together a lot. He knew how I climbed, how I liked to climb. And they felt like there was an interesting story there just about, you know, why I was driven to soloing. They knew nothing about the idea of soloing El Cap. And then, you know, they asked me about doing a film, and I was like, oh, well, good timing, because there's this thing I want to do. And I think, you know, when Jimmy heard about El Cap, he found it pretty unnerving in a way, because, I mean, El Cap is really such an iconic wall in climbing. It really holds a huge cultural, it's like at the center of climbing mythology almost. It's like,
it's the Mecca.
Yeah. It really is. And so Jimmy heard that and was like, oh geez. Like, I don't know if I want to be involved in that. Like, that almost sounds like too much, but Chai was like, that sounds like a great film, you know? And then obviously it all came together and ultimately the climb worked out.
Okay. So how does it work? How do they film that? How does that affect? It has to on some level affect, like you have like you said, they know how you climb. This is how I climb. But now all of a sudden they're filming that, you know, there's equipment, there's, you know, they want to get the right shots. How did that affect your ability to climb?
Yeah. Well, so if you've seen the film, you see a fair amount of the filmmakers rappelling down the wall next to me and things. And actually that was a big part of why I was motivated to make the film, was because I knew that to do the preparation that was required to do the climb, I'd have to spend a lot of time hiking to the summit, rappelling down with ropes and equipment and like working on various sections of the climb. And that's actually easier if you have a partner, like basically to carry all the weight up the wall and to rappel down and to do all the rope work. It's actually easier if you have somebody with you, and that person may as well have a camera. You know, it's like one of those classic things where when you have a big goal in climbing, you can kind of ask your friends to help you to some extent, but if it's going to take you months of effort, it's kind of better if the friends are getting paid for something, you know, like if they're cameramen and they're actually like making by working on the project. Because otherwise, you know, none of my friends are that good of friends. Like, they're willing to help for a week or two, but not for months, you know. And so that took months of effort to.
I'm fascinated by the conditioning for it. Is there a certain weight that you always want to climb at?
Not exactly, but I stay within a very narrow band. You know, I'm like, for me personally, I generally fluctuate between say 155 and 160. Though when I free solo at El Cap, I dropped all the way down to 152 and a half. But that, I think that was mostly because I was hiking so much, like going to the top of the wall over and over every day. And so I just got skinnier basically. And I was eating basically a vegan diet at the time and no desserts. Like I have a bit of a sweet tooth. So without eating dessert for many months and then hiking a ton, I just lost a few pounds, which is.
How do you build up and maintain the wrist strength outside of just climbing all the time? Like, how do you build that up? Because it's anybody who's done it, who's not a climber, I think the things you walk away thinking is like, oh my God, my body is not really flexible. I'm not as strong in the place. And then my hands and my wrists, you get done, and you're just like, wow. And you do something lame.
It's all in your forearm. It's like the muscle, like basically your hands. But so you condition your hands mostly by climbing all the time, by just climbing a lot. But then also there are some specific forms of training, like hangboarding, where you hang from a small edge, you can add weight. It's kind of like weightlifting for your fingertips, where you just hang from small edges. But I'm in my bedroom. There's a hangboard above the door behind me. You know, it's like yesterday afternoon, I like trained on the hangboard for an hour.
So how long?
Well, it depends what you're trying to do. I mean, so for me, yesterday I was doing sort of max hangs, like sort of building power. And so I was hanging with one arm from an edge for like a couple seconds. You know, and in a way it feels really silly because you hang for a couple seconds and then you rest for a couple minutes, you know, but it's basically like doing max lifts or something where it's like
full
effort. But when it's all said and done, you've only actually hung for, you know, 2 minutes during your workout, but it's like, it's really, really hard.
Well, you're centralizing all that focus right on your wrist on one, you know, one hand.
Yeah. On your forearms and your fingers for sure. Yeah. And it's not just the muscles, it's like the connective tissue, the tendons, you know.
When you saw the film before it went to, I think Telluride was when it first kind of blew up. When you saw the film, what was your reaction?
Oh, I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen a film by yourself, but I was like, oh, geez. You know, I mean,
that's why I'm interested.
It's you know, it was a complicated reaction because, you know, it's a great film. I could tell that, you know, it's beautifully shot. It did justice to the story. El Cap looked amazing, but nobody wants to see themselves talking for 90 minutes on a big screen. You know, I was like, oh, like that's kind of, I don't know. I mean, I never had strong opinions about what would happen with the film. You know, I was mostly just like, put it out, see what people think about it. And, you know, I was glad that it was well received. I was glad that people enjoyed it. But, you know, let's just say I haven't watched it again since I've seen it in theaters. You know, it's not like you watch a movie.
Well, but when it was so incredibly well received, did that change your ability? You haven't watched it. So, I mean, I'm sure the first time you see it and now you hear your own voice, like, oh my God, people are going to hate my voice, whatever. And then all of a sudden everybody's just going crazy over like, this is amazing. That had to change your perspective a little bit.
Yeah, no, that did a little, and it's super gratifying. And, you know, obviously I was very appreciative. You know, I was glad that people enjoy it. And it's nice because it is legitimately the thing that I'm most proud of in climbing. You know, it's something that I worked very hard for and that I am proud of. And so it's nice to see that it was well received by the broader community. So I'm like, you know, I put years of effort into it and I thought it was really hard. And I'm glad that other people appreciate it in the same way. Cause I'm like, yeah, you know, it's like, I feel good about that.
I read where your mom is the oldest woman to climb El Cap. Is this an accurate?
I'm not positive. It could be true. It could be true.
Now, was she a climber or did she see what you're doing? And then she was like, I want to try that.
So she wasn't a climber until, you know, maybe 10 years ago. So basically I'd been climbing full time for 15 years. And then my mom said that she wanted to go to the climbing gym, try it out. And so she's been a very casual climber ever since then. You know, she climbs a little bit, but now it's been, I don't know, 7, 8, 10 years maybe that she's been sort of casually climbing. And she often, for her birthday, I often take her up a big route in Yosemite, just as like a fun adventure where, you know, I can like kind of guide her up the whole peak. And so over the years, she's kind of taken on bigger walls. And so her goal was to go up El Cap. So she basically learned how to ascend the ropes. And then, you know, I basically guided her up El Cap. And I was like, it was a pretty proud effort for an older lady, you know.
It's amazing. Really amazing. So the podcast, why do it?
Oh, I think, yeah, I mean, that's a good question. But basically, I think that climbing is having a moment, you know, with it going into the Olympics. But it's just an interesting time for climbing because the sport's been blowing up. I mean, COVID aside, gyms have been experiencing tremendous growth. Tons of people are getting into climbing. And it's just interesting because when I do events or when I do, you know, film events, everyone that I meet, it's like, oh, I started climbing 2 years ago. I started climbing 3 years ago. And they all start climbing in the climbing gym, which is great. It's incredible access, but it's just a very different time for climbing now. And so we felt like it was a good moment to share some of the iconic stories of climbing. So sort of the timeless tales from the last, you know, 50 years of climbing, to show a little bit where the sport has come from, but then also to show where it's going. Because most old school climbers they don't even understand the Olympic format. They don't understand what elite competitors are doing. And now it's sort of almost to the point where it's, you know, splitting into different sports. And so it's nice to find some of those stories that tie them together.
Give me one. Give me one iconic story that you're covering. You're going to cover.
Well, I mean, there are a bunch. A lot of them are iconic people. But so the first episode is a fun interview with Peter Croft, who's this legendary free soloist who actually he appears in the film Free Solo as well. Yeah. He's the older guy that I chat with. And he was a huge inspiration for my climbing. You know, I saw the things that he had done and it really showed me what was possible for humans. And then I sort of took that a step further with things like El Cap. But we chat with Peter quite a bit about where his vision came from, like why he felt like it was possible for him to do things that nobody else thought were possible. And then more importantly, where the limits of that vision take you. You know, like why did he never look at El Cap and think that might be possible? And then, you know, why is it hard for me to see past El Cap? You know, like basically they're generational limits where it's like each climbing generation can see certain big goals, but beyond that, it's like, who knows? You know,
it's interesting. It's like I'll give you the basketball analogy. Like when we watch the dunk contest now, you're like, why didn't guys go around their back and through their legs and dunk it when it was Michael Jordan? And it was like, again, there's like just a generational ceiling where Jordan took what Dr. J had done, taken off from the free throw line, and he cocked it back instead of just anyway. So
the interesting thing though with basketball is presumably the physical limits are roughly the same. I mean, people probably jump almost as high, they run almost as fast. I mean, probably that stuff is a little faster, but like human potential is relatively similar. You know what I mean? It's not like people nowadays are running way faster than people 25 years ago.
But slightly, and like you, like, you know, I don't know if people previous to you trained the way you did, eat the way you did. And the technology is, even if it's just very slightly, there is slightly better, right?
Yeah, no, totally. In climbing, for sure, that makes a difference. Like the shoes are better, the chocolate, like, but it's
right. So it's the same thing in basketball. Like, have you ever seen like Chuck Taylor's, like dudes are going to jump. It's not, it might just be slightly, but it'll be better. And
what's crazy about that though is all those little tiny incremental shifts. Like you wouldn't think that a pair of sneakers makes that big a difference, but when you add up like all the little things, like you're saying, diet and fitness and, you know, conditioning equipment, and then you add the cultural differences where you're like, oh, I saw, you know, I grew up watching videos of a guy do a certain thing. You're like, I'm gonna be better than that, you know. And then it's just crazy, like what happens each generation. You know, it's like there's just such change. I don't know. I mean, so basically, that's what we're trying to explore through the podcast is like. Yeah, I mean, because we're actually kind of looking at three different generations of climbing, or almost four if you count like the modern elite Olympic style. It's basically like a fourth generation of climbers. And there's just been just tremendous change. And I mean, even more that like a sport like basketball, it's like, yeah, the sneakers change. But a sport like climbing, the original pioneers of climbing, their ropes would actually physically break. Like their ropes weren't guaranteed to catch falls. Like nowadays, you can trust your rope like 100% with your life. Like a rope will always catch you. But back in the day, ropes snapped all the time routinely. So obviously that's a completely different, you know, it totally changes the way you climb if you can't actually trust your safety equipment.
How do you, like, there has to be that in the, you know, how do you understand your own limits? I guess that's the thing, because if you look at what you've accomplished thus far, you push the limits of what most people think a human being is capable of doing, right? But how do you in your own mind go like, I can't do that. It's just not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I know. And that's an interesting question. And that's something that as a soloist, you have to wrestle with all the time, because, you know, there's always the desire to do cool things, but then you have to reconcile that with whether or not it's possible, you know,
right.
But I think for me, a lot of that just comes down to sort of, you know, subjective feeling. Like if I look up at a wall and it fills me with dread, I'm like, oh, that makes me feel a little sick to my stomach. Or often you feel overwhelmingly need to go poo. You know, you're like, oh, my stomach just dropped. You're like, that doesn't, you know, when things like that happen, like basically if it feels really scary, you're probably not ready for it is my takeaway.
Okay. What's your white whale? What's the climb you want to do? You haven't yet done. You always want to do it. It's like, life timing, whatever, hasn't happened yet.
I mean, El Cap was my white whale for right. 10 years, basically. Beyond that, I can imagine a few other big climbs, but they don't mean as much to me as El Cap, partially because they aren't as local. They aren't as personal. You know, I mean, because I grew up a couple hours away from Yosemite. So, you know, I remember going camping there as a kid. It's like El Cap was something that's always not just the centrality in the climbing world, but also in my personal life. You know, it's like camping below and thinking how inspiring it is and things like that. So, you know, a lot of the other climbing objectives around the world sort of lack that personal attachment. But no, I mean, there's some things I'd like to do in bigger mountains. There are a lot of historic free solos that have been done in Europe that I'd like to go repeat.
Like the Alps?
Yeah, exactly. The Alps and the Dolomites in Northern Italy. But so, you know, I'd like to go repeat some of those kinds of things. I mean, I don't know. I've always been a fan of climbing history too. You know, it's like if other people from my generation or previously have done hard climbs, I'd like to go repeat some of those. And so that gives me plenty of things to do.
I would guess, and I've experienced this with my basketball podcast, but with your podcast, that you'll go and obviously because of free solo, everybody's going to know you, but you'll get invited to, you know, to any and every climb, and there'll be somebody in, you know, the most remote place, and they'll say like, I listen to your podcast. The podcast thing is really remarkable on how easy it translates, and people can listen to it at their own pace. And especially when it's hyper-focused on something that you're into, I think you'll find it's going to resonate in a level that's ridiculous.
That's interesting. We'll see. Since I have no experience with it, I'm like, I have no expectation. Though honestly, that's pretty similar to the film Free Solo coming out. You know, it's like, right. Not like I knew anything about movies. I was just like, this is going to be a crazy ride. Let's just see what happens. And so the podcast feels very much the same. We've been working on it for the last 6 months. So, you know, it's like we've just been working away in my closet, actually, is my sound studio. So I just sit in my closet and I chat with other climbers and we have a good conversation, and I have no expectation for what will happen with it. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens when it releases.
When you moved into your house in 17, you didn't have any furniture. So you just lived in your van in the driveway.
Yeah. For the first couple of weeks, I guess. I closed on the house and all I had was Wi-Fi. Like I had a wireless router in the house, but no furniture. But
so you just used it as a hotspot. It's the most expensive hotspot in the history of hotspots.
And it was perfect because the driveway, at least I was like, well, it's my driveway, so I can park here as long as I want. No one's ever going to hassle me. You know, I can use the bathroom. So I was like, oh, this is perfect. I have Wi-Fi, I have a bathroom, and then I have perfect parking where no one's going to disturb me. So I just lived on the driveway for a while.
Okay. You mentioned all this camping that you've done. Like, are you an expert camper? Like, can you start your own fire without, you know, just use the wood and do that deal?
No. I mean, I have done that in a few places, and I have been with people who are quite good at that kind of thing. But no, I mean, I would consider myself an expert American West van camper, you know, so I'm very good at feeling out what's public land, what's private land, where you might get shot at, where you won't get shot at, where someone's going to break into your car, you know, whether a neighborhood's going to be quiet or not, things like that, you know, but those.
So you always sleep in your car, you don't do the tent?
No. I mean, the whole beauty of a van is that, I've lived out of a van for basically 15 years, and that allows you to travel all over the West, follow the weather, follow good conditions, climb, you know, full time. But I try to avoid a tent when possible, basically because it's just not as comfortable. You know, the van is like a tiny little mobile apartment. And so it's like my apartment just goes to wherever I need to climb.
This is the hardest one. The most, if you close your eyes and it's like, this is my spot on earth. That's the most beautiful place that I've been. Is it El Cap? Where is it?
Yeah, it's maybe El Cap Meadow. It's maybe Patagonia in southern Argentina. It's like big mountain range. And
Okay. So I've had the gear. I've done the Patagonia gear. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Give me the verbal description of when, if you, having been there, this is why Patagonia is one of the most spectacular places on earth.
Oh, Patagonia is just so wild. It feels like a prehistoric Yosemite because it's huge granite spires, but there's still active glaciers all over. There are huge snow fields tumbling down the sides of the granite peaks. I mean, it's like big, you know, silver granite teeth sticking out of primeval glaciers. It's totally wild with huge lakes. And it's just like it's an epic landscape in the true sense of the word epic, you know, like beyond human scope. It's like, it's awe-inspiring in the conventional sense of the term where you're like, whoa, you know, it's really, really impressive. But
Sounds amazing. Well, look, man, I can't wait to hear the pod. And you know, everybody knows the movie is spectacular, and it's amazing to meet you. And I really, really appreciate your time.
No, I appreciate you taking time away from basketball. You know, I know to talk about something other than ball sports, it's a big deal. I appreciate it.
No, it's to me, it's interesting people and interesting stories in sports. And what you end up having is this, this unique respect. I think there's the respect for what the sport of climbing, because it is a true sport. And I agree. It's going to have a huge summer. It's going to be really amazing to see it when it's in the Olympics. Plus, here's the other, we talk about equipment. I mean, how much has the GoPro changed everything, right? To now you're seeing POV of what it's like, and it's incredible. And so I'll be interested to see how NBC shoots it, what it looks like, but it should be amazing for your sport.
Totally. Well, actually, also, I'm supposed to be doing commentary for the Olympics this summer, so I'm supposed to be there chatting about it. I don't know what that entails exactly, but so a big part of starting the podcast was so that I personally could learn how to talk about these kinds of things so that I wouldn't totally embarrass myself at the Olympics, because I kind of thought that the podcast would be perfect practice for, you know, live commentary. So I was like, oh no, I have no idea how to do that. So
yeah, you have to do what's called tighten it up, 15 to 45. Okay.
Yeah, I'll ask you for advice when the time comes. I'm like, so how do I do this?
I would lie. I'd love to help. Hey, man, thanks for your time. Pod's going to be awesome. We appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
If you haven't seen it, you should see it. The New York Times said Alex Honnold's free solo climb should be celebrated as one of the great athletic feats of any kind ever. Like, that's crazy. Crazy, crazy, crazy. What he was able to do. I can't imagine. Can you imagine? No, thanks. I'm not scared of heights. I'm scared of falling for heights. That's my big thing. Anyway, hope you enjoyed that conversation. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.